First Take, Her Take, hosted by Elle Duncan, Kimberly A. Martin, and Charlie Arnold, gives you a peek into their lives as they navigate their careers and relationships while giving their unfiltered opinions on the sports world's hottest topics. Listen to First Take, Her Take wherever you find your podcasts. Welcome to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain, a podcast about, well, whatever the hell I want. Actors and musicians, athletes, comedians, neuroscientists, wine experts. If I find somebody interesting, I'm bringing them to you. We'll talk about how they became who they are, how they found success, battled failures, and how they ended up here talking to me.
Hi, I'm Q Richardson, and my dilemma is uncomfortable shoes.
What's wrong with them? You have like the world's biggest sneaker collection.
I do, but I recently had to come to LA this weekend and I had to go to a wedding, and I was advised by my wife to wear hard bottom shoes when I had normally been wearing, like you say, I wear J, I have been wearing J's with everything. She's like, babe, this is black tie. And my feet paid a hefty price for that.
Ah, yes, the old Kate Fagan, uncomfortable shoes at a wedding. Okay, so a few years ago, my former colleague Kate came to me asking about a dilemma of her own. Was it okay if she wore Jordans to my wedding? Obviously. Of course, please do. I'll be disappointed if you don't. So she was all set to, and then some other folks got in her ear. They said it wasn't appropriate. So she went out and bought fancy heels, which she promptly got stuck in the flooring of the barn in which we held the reception. Eventually changed into the Jordans she brought. Honestly, never should have worried about the right shoes when the best shoes, the most comfortable shoes, the coolest shoes, the goat shoes were right there. So while I understand your wife wanting you to look appropriate, you know, J's in a suit can't be beat. So next time you got to fight for your right to rock the J's. In the meantime, if your feet are hurting from the uncomfortable shoes, second skin blister stuff is the best. I rocked that all through college. I always had issues with my feet from heptathlon, and that second skin stuff, I'll get you right.
That's what she said.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. This is episode 343. This week's guest is the delightful Quentin Richardson, former NBA player, spent 13 seasons in the association, played for the Clippers, Suns, Knicks, Heat, and Magic, won the NBA three-point contest in 05. He currently works for the Fox Orlando Magic broadcast team, co-hosts the Knuckleheads podcast with longtime friend and former teammate Darius Miles for the Players Tribune. He's a Chicago native, so of course we had to talk about coming up in the best city in the world. We got deep into some of the trauma he had to deal with his mother's death and the murders of two of his brothers, why he wishes that he had embraced therapy earlier in life when dealing with that stuff, opposing teams throwing locks at his squad in high school, the fans of those teams, his brief engagement to Brandy back in the day, the singer, why he decided to play in the Big Three after his retirement, all sorts of other stuff. Q is awesome. You're going to dig this.
That's what she said.
So excited to have Quentin Richardson on the podcast. I feel like I'm turning the tables on you now that you've become a professional podcaster. And so, keeping in mind the spirit of Knuckleheads podcast, your podcast, I'm starting you off with a reverse of the first question you ask everybody. You guys always ask everyone when you got to the league, who was the person that busted your ass up first? So instead, I want to ask you if you remember who in the league you got that first moment on, where you crossed them up or you dunked on or you did something and you were like, hey, welcome to the league.
Oh, man. I felt like the same game. I don't want to say it was like a moment where I crossed somebody over or anything. For me, it was when I got in the league and my first bucket. I want to say it was in Denver, but I can't remember exactly. But when I scored my first bucket, I was like, ugh. I was like, I'm here.
Isn't so tough. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's, you know, it was just like, it was a, I guess you could say a stepping stone, because you knew it was going to happen, but it was how, when, where. It wasn't anything spectacular, but for me, that was enough just to know that, I got that out the way. Let's go.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's go all the way back then to what got you to that first bucket and that beginning of your career. You grew up in Chicago, which I love because we get all the good stories from back in the day. What neighborhood did you grow up in, and were you into sports right off the bat?
Absolutely. I'm from the South Side, from the 100s to the Roseland area, 115th Parnell. right there. Went Whistler Elementary School, so you know that whole area right there, Cooper Park. That's where I'm born and bred.
And you were into hoops like right off the bat. Did you know you were going to be super tall?
No, I didn't. I mean, I kind of hit my growth spurt. I mean, my growth spurt late compared to, I feel like, my peers and stuff like that. I feel like going into freshman and sophomore years when I got to be 6'2", 6'5", two summers in a row, and I was waiting for another 3 inches, but I didn't get it after that. But still, I felt like I got my spurt late. But, I played ball, you know, from as long as I can remember, my brothers, cousins, friends in the neighborhood. I mean, that was what we did. We started on the crate, you know, we from Chicago. We cut the bottom out of the crate, go behind a Wendy's or Burger King or something, and grab the crate, cut the bottom of it, throw it on the pole in the alley out there, the telephone pole, the electric pole, and we get into it with a mini ball.
You hear a lot about the guys who grew up playing in Chicago. Not only how you learn to take a foul and finish, because you're probably not calling it almost any of the time that it happens. You're not going to call a foul. You're just going to play through it. But also that if people see talent, they try to protect you. And I know we talked about that here in Chicago a ton with Derrick Rose, especially at his size, that there was this feeling like he had something special and the neighborhood had to like keep him out of trouble and foster the hoops. Did you feel that when you were coming up? Like this is bigger than just like playing outside with my friends.
I think it got to that point when you first start out, when you know, I wasn't somebody that was spectacular like that out of the bat and something like that. But I think once I got to, you know, eighth, ninth grade and you started to see it and they started to see how serious I was with it, I think, in the neighborhood, as long as you don't do anything, you know, to cross the line or do anything offensive, like to intentionally start something, I think, you know, it was like that. Our era was like that, where they kind of protected them and said, yo, young boy, you know, leave little dude alone. He play ball or whatever like that. And, you know, they would even if you were trying to sometimes show up around something silly, they'd be like, yo, man, get from around here. What you doing over here? You know, that type of deal. Right. So, yeah, we definitely grew up in that type of era.
So you're playing basketball. You've got four siblings when you're growing up?
Yes.
And so older siblings that showed you the ropes or older siblings that would never let you win? Like, what was this? Was this like wrestling matches in the middle of basketball games?
I would say the only one I really played ball against was my brother Lee, who I lost in 06. But he was the one who was closest to me in age. Everybody else was a lot older. My two older brothers didn't even live in the house anymore by the time I started to really play. But other than that, I really grew up playing with and against my cousins that were like brothers to me, because it was a lot of us around the same age. So it was like, even the ones that were old, they were a year or two older, and we were running behind them trying to play and stuff like that. So that was the kind of the environment over there in Cooper Park where I grew up with my cousins and then different friends. And we would get out of school from Whistler and the park was a block away. And, you know, we'd have our backpacks, not even go home. We at the park playing at the playground before we go to my grandmother's house, who was right there on 118th and Troop. So it was like everything was right there. And that was really how I grew up playing ball.
Yeah. What did your parents do for a living?
My pops and my mom both worked for CTA. I lost my mom in seventh grade.
Yeah.
And but my pops still, he worked. He drove the CTA train 39 years. He didn't even, Whoa. Even when I made the league, he didn't allow me to retire him until way after. I
was really?
Almost, yeah, I was almost out the league before he allowed me to retire him.
Huh. Yeah, you mentioned your mom. I know you wrote a Players Tribune story and it was really moving how you had 1 year. There's a couple years in your life when I was doing the research for this that really stood out. And 92 was one of them. Your mom died of breast cancer. Your mm-hmm. grandma died of natural causes. And then your brother Bernard, who was 23 at the time, was shot and killed.
Yeah.
That's a whole lot to go through in seventh grade. What do you remember about what you had to tell yourself to like power through, but maybe what other people were telling you about having those things happen all in a row?
I can remember firmly, like, once, you know, my mom was the last one of the three. And when she passed, I can remember totally like shutting down, because it was like, you got to understand the dynamic. My sister was in college, so she had a job and she was in college. My older brother, he was there, but he was in high school getting ready to go leave for the Navy, my brother Lee. My pops, now driving the CTA, he would get up at 4 a.m. and he wouldn't get back until about 4 or 5. So nobody knew, you know what I'm saying, what I was doing. I was just like, I was just sitting there like, all right, I wasn't going to school at first. My grade school coach, Mr. Gary Adams, he passed recently, a couple years ago. But he was really the one who got me, like, up off the couch and like, all right, come on. He would show up to my house every morning, just blow the horn. And I look out the window and he, and you know, I was finally, after probably about 2 weeks of him doing it, came outside and talked to him. He like, what are you going to do? He like, you can't do this, you know, forever. And this, that, and the third. And I was like, well, you know, whatever. He like, well, I'm going to keep showing up until, you know what I'm saying, you come on and you go. So then probably maybe a day or two later, I went and, you know what I'm saying, when I felt like when I got to basketball practice and stuff like that, that was like the only time where I really wasn't thinking about everything that was going on. That was the one time where, okay, I could, once I got the plan and got the hoop and I really lost myself in the hoop and it wasn't really thinking about nothing else. So that's what made me go back to school that during that period of time and get back to basketball. But before that, I was just like, you know, 12 years old, I didn't know what the hell was going on. Right. I was like, what's happening? Like, I can't believe all this is happening at once. And then, you know, seeing what it's doing to my family and stuff like that, that was tough.
Yeah, and I think it's a cliche, but for good reason for a lot of people, that thing that they're passionate about, whether it's music or sports or whatever, just getting back into it when you're in those tough times can actually really save you. And it's true. You end up at Whitney Young Magnet School in Chicago, great place for basketball. A lot of great players have come out of there. But you talk about how people would treat you differently when you came to play other schools, including stuff like throwing locks at you on the court. Like, yeah. That's wild. Take me back to, like, what was it like being at Whitney Young?
Listen, Whitney Young, you got to understand, when we got there, like, I came as a sophomore, so I went to Brother Rice for my freshman year. Then I transferred, but the year before, my best friends, Cordell Henry and Dennis Gates, they went there straight away. They went there as freshmen, played against Kevin Garnett and Ronnie and Fields and all of that. So when I get there my sophomore year, you know, they were still known. Whitney Young was known as the academic school, you know, the magnet school, the, you know, kind of the nerd school or whatever. And so we hadn't won anything as far as like in the city. And then we playing in the Red West, which is like the toughest, you know, league in the city. And we had to go play the lock thing happened at Orr. You know what I'm saying? It was like, and you know, the thing that was crazy about my team and my class, six out of the seven main players, we were all from the South Side, playing on the West Side, you know what I'm saying? Playing in the Red West. But so we started the whole, you know, before we got there, they was looking at us like, yo, they not, you know, these is nerds, these is good kids, about to get good grades, but they didn't realize it, like, yeah. We all of that you're saying, we good kids and about to get good grades. We got a great GPA across the board on our team.
Yep.
But we different. Like, we could really hoop. And, like, however you want to hoop. And the thing that we had in our favor is that myself, Cordell, and Dennis Gates, we all played since seventh grade together. We played AAU with Larry Butler on the Illinois Warriors. So we had, you know how it is, it's kind of one of those things, that continuity that we had was going to supersede a lot. And, I mean, like, I was a McDonald's All-American, but Dennis and Cordell was great in their own right. Cordell went to Marquette. Dennis Gates went to Cal. You know what I'm saying? He's now coaching. And, like, both of those guys were great players in their own respect. So with that continuity, we were able to dominate once we got there.
You won the state title. I mean, that's beyond just being a little bit unexpected and better than they thought. 98, you win it all. You're actually years later named one of the 100 legends of the IHSA, Illinois High School Association basketball tournament. What do you remember about? I mean, that's pretty good. Of all the times that's been contested, for you, your performance to stand out as one of the best ever.
I tell you the truth. To be honest, when I look back at it myself, Dennis and Cordell, when we lost our junior year, senior year was a foregone conclusion. I'm not even like that. Like, when we won it, it's like, obviously we were excited, we were happy, and we were, but the one we wanted was junior year. Cause that was like, cause when we came back, everybody, we were number one, everybody expected that. We wanted the one that no one expected. And that was the one that hurt the most. Like, cause we felt like we could have got it, but we didn't get it done. But we wanted the one junior year. Senior year was I can firmly remember, because me and Cordell was laughing. Dennis Gates was crying. I'm like, what you crying for, bro? Like we knew this was happening.
Yeah,
like, we knew this
that's
was
confidence.
Happening. Like, yeah, like, we got to a point, because I think we lost one game that season. We lost to, like, Lexington Catholic. And I can remember being upset after the game, and that the press was asking this. And I said, hey, we ain't losing no more. And then they were like, wait, are you trying to say?
Called your shot.
I said, you can say however you want. I said, we not losing no more. We weren't supposed to lose the game. I remember my coach, Coach Stan, George Stan, he came to me. He was like, you can't be doing this. I'm like, what you mean? He's like, I understand if you feel like you can handle it, but you're putting pressure on your team. I say, man, I say, they with me. We good. You know, every game that it was a big game, they would try and come up. And I can remember my pops. He was like, you shouldn't have said that. And he kind of made me want to recant. But every time I wanted to do it, it was like the media, the way they came at me, they kind of antagonized me and made me harder with it. I'm a 16, 17-year-old kid. I'm like, nah, we not losing. So I'm doubling down and tripling down.
That's great. So who'd you lose to junior year?
We lost to, did we lose to Manuel downstate? I think we lost to Peoria Manuel downstate. We won City back-to-back, and we went downstate, but I think we lost to Peoria Manuel with Frank Williams, Sergio McClain, and Marcus Griffiths and all of them. They, you know, that was Serge's fourth year in a row winning state.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
How did you decide to go to DePaul and stay here in Chicago?
Man, it came down to Kansas and DePaul. And like you just got through saying, you know, all that I went through with my family. And then, you know, at that point, my brother was just returning, you know, home from the Navy and stuff like that. So I'm like, man, the family is here. Like, they'll be able to come to, you know, damn near all of my games. Even the games not in DePaul, you know, we going to St. Louis, Marquette, very close cities where they can travel easily and come see me play. So that was really what overwhelmingly. And then the fact that, like, I knew that what we were doing, you know, with Bobby and Lance going there, and they had committed before me in the talk that, you know, they hadn't had three guys that highly ranked from the city since Mark McGuire and Terry Cummings and those type of guys, and the excitement that we had going on with that. I was excited about that, too. I'm a Chicago kid.
Yeah. I mean, it is awesome to be somewhere where your whole family can come support you. And when you take that next big step, you've got that support system, particularly having gone through what you did. I wonder, you know, being in Chicago in the years after your brother was murdered and you're trying to carry on, you know, the expectations for you as a basketball player and going to college and everything else. Did you get caught up ever in wanting to avenge that? Did you find out who it was, and was it something that like you could ever put away, or does it constantly remind you when you don't leave the city that it happened in?
Nah. So for me, with my brother Bernard, I was so young that I was, you know, it was no way, you know, that happened when I was 12. It was no way by the time I was even, you know, when I became a teenager, 16, 17, especially going through high school and getting to college, that was so far gone that it wouldn't even make sense for me to be trying to avenge that or something like that. But with my brother Lee, it's funny because, you know, I'm in the NBA. I'm 26 years old, and I obviously have access to certain things, and I have finances for certain things, and I had a chance to really do something like that. And it came down to a situation where I was like, I don't want that on my heart. Like, whatever whatever they got coming to them is gonna come, like, you know what I'm saying, without me doing a thing. And like, I know that my brother wouldn't want me to do something like that, more importantly. So, you know, I didn't do it, but I literally had a chance to.
Yeah. Yeah, because I know a lot of people, things like that happen, family tragedy, and sometimes they actually want to leave the city where it happened and have a fresh start. But for you, it was really important to have that continuity with the family that you had, especially with your brother coming home. So tell me about being at DePaul. You know, you were tremendous there. Only player in school history with 1,000 points, 500 boards, 100 three-pointers. You obviously, you know, were continuing to excel. It felt like the NBA was certainly on the way. So how does that go down with friends and family in the city? I mean, was it raucous? Was it crazy? Did you have the embarrassing family that were super loud? Did you have the kind of quiet, confident ones?
Like, it was all love for me, man. I had all of that. Like, when I say I had cousins that showed up and, you know, yell at the security that they need to be going this way because Q Rich is my cousin and that's my cousin. And, you know, my pops and my, you know, my pops and my immediate family would kind of be, you know, chill and you know, kind of, but like still, like I loved all of that, man. I had cousins, you know, family, my immediate family, I was there a lot, many, many friends coming and going. So for me, it was just like, this was what it was all about. I was playing, you know, some of the best teams in Cincinnati and different, you know, we played Duke at the United Center. I got my whole family there, and it's like the biggest game in, you know, Chicago, you know, college basketball history. And it's like, we doing this at Little DePaul when they said we couldn't.
Yeah.
We playing all of the teams. We playing Kansas. We playing DePaul. So I was getting, Duke. So I was getting that same exposure that everybody was trying to sell me on. The school that was trying, like, I was getting that, but I was getting it right here at the crib. I could leave a game against Duke and go to my pop's crib and really chill. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And like that was the regular thing for me. So, like, that was, and then I could see them immediately at the game. They could see me and experience all of that with me. So, like, that was the real icing on the cake for me.
Well, I wonder if that set you up okay for the NBA, because then you've spent your whole life in Chicago. You didn't even go to, like, Illinois or Indiana. Like, you didn't even go somewhere close. Like, you stayed in the city, and then you get drafted number 18 by the Clippers. So it's all the way across the country, and it is a totally different lifestyle, totally different, you know, scene out there. As someone who lived in LA for 6 years, like, there's culture shock when you get out there. So you only spent 2 years in college before you get drafted. So tell me about, you know, were you excited about the Clippers, first of all? And then when you got there, what did you expect?
Initially I was upset because I felt like I was a, you know, a higher pick than 18, but, you know, I dealt with that. And it was like, I looked at it as an opportunity because I knew that they were like, they had the worst record in the NBA the season before that. And it was like, they got three high first round picks for a reason. So it's like,
right,
you know what I'm saying? Like, we're gonna get a chance to go in here and play. So for me, I was excited. As far as, you know, LA is a thing, like, I had only been out here one other time. We played UCLA when I was in college, and we came out here to play UCLA. But I didn't really get a chance. You know, you in college, you don't get to do nothing.
Right.
So it's like, this was my first time touching down. They flew us private from the draft. Like, me and D Miles was at the draft. They flew us in private. Like, this is the first time we on a private jet. Like, we didn't know how to act. Like, you couldn't have told us that we wasn't, like, you know, we thought we was Martin Lawrence and Will Smith and Bad Boy.
We'll get right back to the interview. But first, what is your favorite word?
Fun.
Okay. So the way we see it, diversion, amusement, mirthful sport, came about in around 1727. But before that, it originally meant a cheat or trick, circa 1700, from the verb fun in the 1680s, which meant to cheat or hoax. Uncertain origin, but they think it might be a variant of the Middle English faunin, which means befool. So this actually kind of makes sense, because that older meaning is sort of preserved in some sayings that we still use, like to make fun of from 1737, funny money, 1938, counterfeit bills. That might be more about the rhyme, but that's wild. I've never thought, like, why to make fun of means something mean, but that totally checks out with that original meaning of cheating or fooling or hoaxing. Good one. Speaking of great words,
you're going to learn today.
The word of the week, this one goes out to Pablo Torre. He rolled this word right off his tongue effortlessly in a mid-sentence in a recent episode of ESPN Daily. So I texted him props for the flawless inclusion of the word synecdoche. And he admitted that he actually should have used the word metonym. You could Google the difference between a synecdoche and a metonym, but we'll dive into synecdoche here. So it's a figure of speech in which a part is taken for the whole, or vice versa, from the late 15th century, from medieval Latin, and from the Greek synecdoche, the putting of a whole for a part, and understanding one with another, quite literally, a receiving together or jointly. So a synecdoche is typically when you take an attribute or an adjunct and then you substitute it for the whole thing. So look at those suits over there. Suits being a synecdoche for businessmen. Wheels for a car. Mouths, as in hungry mouths to feed. Hired hand for a worker. You are not, of course, hiring just their hands. They are a worker, but you call them hands. So in a sentence, the captain commands 100 sails is a synecdoche that uses sails to refer to ships, ships being the thing of which a sail is a part. So see if you could pull a Pablo and effortlessly drop into a sentence Well, of course, that is a synecdoche for. Please note, this is not the same as Schenectady, the city in New York. It is not the same as Schenectady, New York. Okay, just wanted to get that out there. Now let's get back to the interview. So you get drafted, you move to LA, and you and Darius Miles were in a documentary chronicling your first three seasons with the Clippers called The Youngest Guns. I love that, like, you guys got drafted together, you did the doc together, now you're doing the podcast together. This is a lifelong bromance that we have here. But tell me about that documentary. Have you seen it recently? Are there, like, cringe moments when you look back at your young self?
Oh, man, it is not good. It is not good. It's hilarious to watch, though. Like you say, when you look at it, especially now, you're so much older, and you look at the stuff that you thought was cool, the stuff
right.
you were doing, the way that you was dressing, acting, talking, everything, the way we sounded, it's hilarious. It's just, I remember it all, too, because it was like, I could remember when they came to us, like, yo, these guys, they want to do, because, you know, obviously we would come to LA and it was a kind of a turning point. Because like I say, our team was kind of unique in the sense that we were the first real team that has 5, 6, 7 core guys that were all like under 21, 22 years
right.
old.
I mean, three picks in the top 18 is a lot.
Yeah, and you had an 18-year-old coming out of there. Darius was the highest pick ever out of high school at that point. You know, the years following, Kwame went number one and things like that. But before that, Darius was the highest one to ever go and the youngest one. And then I was 19. Keon was 19. Corey was 19. Mm-hmm. LO was 19. Like, it was like the whole team was 18, 19, 20. And so it was like the guys, they were interested in doing the doc. And, you know, they got in touch with our agent and we worked it out. They literally were around for, like you say, it was crazy. 3 years. They followed us overseas after the first season. We went to like Paris and all of these different places, Germany. Like, we saw Tony Parker when he was coming up.
No way.
Like,
that's
when he
wild.
Was like, yeah, before he really like exploded. When we went over there for that Nike trip, he was on it. Like, he was a Nike kid. So like, he was all the rage. They was like, he's going to be this. And like, sure enough, he came and he did it.
You mentioned Corey Maggette, who was on the Clippers when you got there. He joined at the same time. Another Chicago guy. He was the one that, especially because I grew up in Lake Forest, you know, we played Oak Park in field hockey. Yeah. So we would always be hearing about Corey Maggette and how great he was. Did you guys have an instant bond because of Chicago, or was there a rivalry there from when you'd played against each other?
See, the thing that people don't know a lot about me and Corey played against each other for the first time in sixth grade.
Whoa.
So like, me and him go way back. Like, it's like playing against each other. Then you fast forward to 15-year-old, we go to the national championship playing for the Warriors. He played with my team.
You were AAU together. Okay.
Yeah, we went and won the nationals. Then like after that, he went and joined a different team. And so we were back opponents again. Then you go to high school. We played against each other in the city suburban shootout at Northwestern. Then, like, we were number one, they were number two then. And yep. me and Corey were like 1A, 1B players.
And then he's at Duke, like you said.
And then we play against each other. So, like that's like, and like, that's really like my brother. Like, we got a bond. It's like crazy. Like, I'll see him while I'm here now. And it's like, we went and played for the Power in the Big Three and won a championship.
Yeah.
Together. Like, he was the captain of that team. He came and called me like, yo, bro, I need you to come play. I'm like, all right. And, you know, like, me
that's
and Corey,
awesome.
Like, our families are tight. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, that's really like somebody that's like family to me. And like, that was like the early outset of it. Like, when we got to the Clippers, and the crazy part, like you say, he was joining the team. Like, as I was walking up on the stage to shake David Stern's hand, they were announcing that trade across the PA.
Amazing.
Corey Maggette and Derek Strong was being traded from the Magic to the Clippers. And I was like, this is crazy. Because I knew Keon from AAU. Obviously, I knew Darius since he was in 7th, 8th grade. I was in 9th, 10th grade. And it was like, I was like, man, it's about to be like, that's one. That was like four of us that we all know each other. Where it's about to be like coming in, we're going to be able to lean on each other and experience stuff together. So that was
cool. That makes that move a whole lot easier to go across the country and to be in the pros all of a sudden at that young age. How long into your career, how long after you got drafted, did you sign with Team Jordan? Because you were one of the first And you've been a lifer for Team Jordan.
Well, that's the blessing, man. We literally, so we got drafted, and over the summer, like MJ, he doesn't have it anymore, but every summer, like August 1st to August 10th, he would have his fantasy camp for kids out in Santa Barbara where they can, you know, it'd be thousands of kids come, and they some stay overnight, some are just day campers where they stay in the hotel with their kids and their parents, and they drop them off back and forth. But they, what he would do, he would have normally like the top college players around the country come there and be counselors for it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? They would be counselors. So after the day, you would do the counselors games, and it would be, you know, intense pickup games with high competition. So me and D had done that coming up through the circuit when I was in DePaul, and when he was a top player in the country, he did it. And so we were like, you know, we got drafted. We both had been there together previously. And so we was like, man, let's go to, you know, we had got to L.A. and we was out in L.A. working out. We was like, man, let's go down to Jordan camp. You know, they're going to have, you know, it's going to be the who's who of their plan. We get right. The runs in. So we go down there. And at that point, they were, you know, our agent was negotiating our deal. Jeff Wexler was going back and forth with the Nike and, you know, everything. But at the time, you know, N1 was a big deal. And they was trying to flash. And so they had just sent us like crazy boxes of stuff. So we mash out. We go down there to Santa Barbara with all this N1 stuff on. So we get through with the runs one day, and MJ like, what? I thought y'all were Nike guys. Like, why y'all got on this junk? And we like, you know, we go to explain kind of what's going on, and MJ was just like, y'all don't worry about it. Like, y'all gonna be with me. And so
nice. He
like, y'all get rid of all this stuff. So we like, we didn't really know what that meant, but we were just like, man, Jella said it. So, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. If Jordan's in, we're in.
Right. So, you know, the next day our agent called us and he tell us like, yo, you know, you're going to be with Jordan and he's going to have like a team of guys. And I'm like, okay, like you're going to get all the Jordan gear. We like, oh, but like when we really, we didn't understand it till like all of them boxes started arriving.
Yeah.
Like when I say it was something we had never experienced.
It's a dream.
Right. You're looking at a kid that's from the South Side who pops didn't buy me Jordans. The first pair of Jordans I ever received was from Larry Butler, my AAU coach. I was playing ball and we were now sponsored by Nike. Before that, never had any Jordans in my life. Not even a hand-me-down pair. None.
Wow. That's amazing. What a cool way to like feel like you made it too. Now you're in the league with all your guys and Jordan's got you decked out in all the gear.
And the best is that still like today, like Jordan brand takes care of me. Like I get to get my kids Jordan stuff and all.
Oh, I've heard your collection is like legendary. Did you figure out how old are your sons? Because I read you said you need at least one of them to be a size 15 so they could take advantage of all your shoes.
Yeah, so the 18-year-old was a 13 and a half, my stepson, Caleb.
He's at home, layering up socks.
He could put his socks on. He could pull that one off if he really wanted to go there. But I know my boy is 6'5", QJ and crew, they going to be bigger than 15s at some point.
Oh, yeah? How tall is their mom?
She's about 5'7", I think.
All right.
But Cruzy came out. He didn't even wear a newborn diaper. He went straight to size one.
Okay. All right. So we got a shot. And no chance your daughter goes to a men's 15, unfortunately for her.
No, but she's only 8 and she wears a women's 7.
Okay. All right. So for her sake, I don't want her to fit into your shoes, but I hope she gets all the other good stuff that, you know, doesn't require her to wear a size 15.
Oh, she runs the whole house. Believe that.
Good. Good. I want to see all the ballers out of the Richardson household, not just the dudes. So you spend the first couple of years with the Clippers, you end up signing as a free agent with the Suns. And this is another one of those years, you know, 92 was marked by a lot of tragedy for you as you were coming up. It feels like it's 2004-05 season. First of all, you're balling out. You've got a new Suns single season record for 3-pointers passing Dan Marley, who like that's who we always think about
Thunder
as like
Dan.
The man, Thunder Dan. Yeah. Like you still think about that. You go to Arizona, he's still got the restaurants and everything.
Yeah.
Like he's larger than life out there. So you break Dan Marley's record. You're co-leading the league with Korver and threes. The Suns, you know, great record. Go to the Western Conference Finals, and you're engaged to Brandy. Okay, so this is like you are balling on the court and off. And at that time. Like, I feel like there was not a lot of people. Was that still peak Brandy, or is it like a couple years after she was like, that boy is mine? I can't remember.
I don't know. I don't know.
You got to pretend like you don't remember. Let me see. What year was that Boys Blind? Brandy and Monica, for those who don't remember. 98. Okay. All right. So this is a couple years after like the peak Brandy fame, but she's obviously still, tell me about that. That's like a whole different kind of lifestyle than just being an NBA player when you cross over to Hollywood.
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, she was cool. It was down to earth and regular. It was cool.
It was regular. All right. I'll let you off the hook on that one. I'm looking at your facial.
I mean that in a good way. It wasn't, you know, like any of the.
Yeah, it wasn't crazy Hollywood. It was just like two people who liked each other. Yeah. All right. So you were engaged for over a year. You break up in 05. So, you know, you're playing great basketball. Your team is doing really well. And at the end of that year is when the next tragedy happens. You've got all these great things happening for you. And you mentioned earlier, your brother Lee gets murdered. And that was just like a freak robbery, right? Just an accident that he got caught up in.
Yeah. So basically the guys was like on like, I guess, like a kind of robbering type spree. And my brother and my pops were going back to the old house that we grew up in, because my pops was moving to the new house that we got him. So they were going to, you know, get stuff and move stuff back and forth. The way the house was set up, the garage wasn't attached. So when they pulled into the garage and came out, it was like a little, kind of like a little gangway in between the house and there. The guys were waiting there with the guns drawn on them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my brother, he was in the Navy. So he's done this before where he's disarmed people and this, that, and third. And he got the gun from one of the guys. Wow. The other guy shot him. Because it was like, you know, he felt like he had to protect himself and my pops. I don't know what he even did, and my pops wasn't there, but my pops was there too. So, you know what I'm saying? And my pops, it was crazy. My pops, the jacket he was wearing, he had a bullet hole through him, but he didn't get hit.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa. So going through that again, do you handle it better the second time because you know how to handle grief? Or do you feel like, how the f*** does this happen to me twice? Like, this is so unfair.
Yeah, I would say, like I say, hindsight is 20/20. Looking back at it as a 26-year-old, I would say I handled it probably worse. I would say as a youngin, you know what I'm saying, it was only so much you could do. When you 26 years old and you NBA player and you got millions at your fingertips, like, I just drank.
Yeah.
Literally, that, if you go and look, that was when I gained weight in the NBA. Like, that had nothing to do with eating.
Yeah.
Everything to do with alcohol. And I didn't, you know what I'm saying? It was like I was in a place where I didn't even see it.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't even see, like, when I, like, because I can remember it. It was like when I got traded from the Knicks to the Heat and I got to Miami in the summer. Like, I can remember the first thing that happened when I got to the, when I got to this, how gangster Parody was. When I first got to the arena, like, I land in the airport. You know, usually you about to go get take to the hotel. They drop your bags. I'll do. We didn't go to no hotel. No, we came straight from the airport to the arena. So I come in the locker room. I got my bag, and he was like, Bill Ferrin. He was a strength coach. He came. He was standing there waiting on me. He was like, Pat wants you to do bathing body fat. He was like, strip down to your boxers. And I was just like,
you're like, I just got here. Like, you're not gonna take me to lunch at the Fontainebleau and show me some cool beach spots.
So I go, that's what they do. The first thing they do is weight and body fat. He write it down on his little, he got the sticky. He write it down on his little sticky and he sent it upstairs. So now I'm getting back dressed and this, that, and the third. He's like, all right, when you get back dressed, you know, Pat's waiting for you upstairs. Real Godfather vibes. You go in there, it's the offices. It's like the light just over him. It's kind of dark everywhere else. And you talking to him. And I'm like, yo, this is crazy. But like, it was like, literally, like, when I got there and it was like, whatever mask or funk was over me, it was like, it got pulled from over me. And I was like, looking at myself like, man, how the hell you get like this? And I can never, I can't remember exactly how much it was, but I lost like 47, 48 pounds, 50 pounds, something like 6 weeks. It was crazy.
So you had injuries with the Knicks in addition to obviously, you know, dealing with the off the court stuff. So yeah, you end up with the Heat. So this is wild too. So I want to hear about what this day was like for you. So it's 2009 draft day. You're traded from the Knicks to the Grizzlies for Darko Milicic. But you're only technically on the Grizzlies for 3 weeks before you're traded to the Clippers in exchange for Zach Randolph, but you're only with the Clippers for 3 days before you're traded to the Timberwolves. And then a month later, you're traded to the Heat.
Right.
Now, what's going through your mind? And are you like, damn, everybody kind of wants me? Or you're like, damn, nobody wants me enough to keep me.
So this was the thing. Headed into the summer, like, my agent, Jeff Flexer, he's one of the best in the business. I know this in hindsight now because people, these type of things happen to people and they don't understand why. Jeff told me it was a high probability of me getting traded. This was the summer of D-Wade, LeBron, Bosh, all of those guys, the big free agent summer where everybody was trying to get. They were trying to get those expiring contracts.
So I forgot about that. Like, teams were down to like one person on the roster just so they could make space in case that's where they all wanted to go.
They were trying to do, they were trying to get all of these. No, I'm talking about going into that summer. The season into that summer, they were trying to, everybody was trying to like position. They were trying to get all, everybody wanted these big expiring contracts. Like, so I can't remember, I want to say it was like 11 or 12 million that I was making that year that would be coming off the books, freeing up cap space. So that was attractive to teams. And that was the big reason why I was like, boom, you're going here. Nobody could predict that I was going to go as many places. But after the first two, he was like, all right. Because when the first one happened, he was like, I don't know if this is, he was like, I don't know if they may move you again. And then like it happened, then he told me, he was like, you're definitely going to be moved again. You're not staying here. And after the third one, he was like, don't worry. He was like, I'm working on it. And we're gonna see what we're gonna get you settled. But like, you're not gonna be in Minnesota.
Minnesota. Like, did you even like unpack?
I never went anywhere. I went to Memphis and I went to LA. That was it. Then I obviously once the Miami deal was consummated and stuff, I showed up there and I like.
Okay, so this was a lot of like moving you around, but not actually showing up and practicing and all that stuff. It was all off season.
Yeah, at one point I remember tweeting, laughing about it, like, you know, this is like, okay, I'm interested. Where's when we're gonna be next? Like as a joke, because it was, you know, it was hilarious at that point.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Okay, so you ended up with the Heat. Once you got there and you were there for a while, would you still view Pat Riley as Godfather-esque? Like, was that the vibe for the whole time, or did it change, like, when you got to know him?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was still, like, I still look at it as, like, Godfather-esque because I feel like the organization is, you know, from Mickey on down, is ran like a family. And they are who they are because of that. The way they run their business,
culture, it's a lot of continuity. As they always say.
No, it's like you have to really be in it to understand it and to know that it's a real deal. And you know, people will say, "Oh, it's cliche to say this," but like it's not a secret that, you know, it's a common denominator in what's going on over there. It's the way that they have that continuity from top to bottom. And like I said, I was only there for one season, and the respect and the admiration I got for the way they do things and for Riley to from Mickey to Big Andy to Nick to Spo and the whole gang, and the way that he, you know, I love the way that they keep bringing on, you know, everybody they add has somewhat been a part of their culture before. So
yeah,
you know, they doing Malik Allen and Caron Butler, those are peers of mine, is getting a chance to learn in the best case scenario, because you go to a lot of these other organizations and you move your family to work there. You know, we used to being paid millions of dollars.
Right.
And when a lot of guys take these positions, it's for 100, 250, mm-hmm. You moving your family, you need some type of stability. Like, I feel like when you go and you take that leap of faith with the Miami Heat, you're not about to be there for a year. Like, if you go in there and you're doing your job and you working hard and doing what you're supposed to do, you're not about to be there for a year and then the whole staff get fired and you got to figure stuff out.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, that's not going to happen there. So I feel like, you know, they do things the right way. And when people get a chance to be a part of that, it's a blessing.
Have you been watching Winning Time? Because I'm wondering, from my perspective, and I've spent a little bit of time with Pat Riley. I hung out him for actually about an hour at like Dan Lebatard's wedding. He and I really hit it off. So we were talking for a while. Super nice dude. He and his wife are super nice. How do you feel about Adrian Brody? Because from afar, I'm like, that's pretty good. He's doing a good job.
Yo, I've watched that show, and like out of everybody, I felt like, you know, that they were probably kind of fair to him, but like,
yeah,
I've watched the show, but I'm like, yo, like, yo.
They gotta keep putting it to being like, this is a sensationalized, fictionalized version based on mostly truth. But yeah, not everybody's getting escaping as unscathed as Pat Riley is. That's for sure.
I agree 100%. It's like, yo, this is like on the wild side. It's
yeah. I had Adam McKay on my podcast right before it started, and now I'm like, oh, I want to have him back and be like, yeah, tell me now about the reaction, because it's been pretty crazy. I don't know if he even anticipated quite the way that people would be going after him.
I think it's a good show. It's entertaining until I think, like, what if that was you? Like,
right.
Like, damn.
Right.
Like, I'd be right. Like, man, like, I shouldn't like this show like this.
Yeah. I like Spencer Haywood's reaction where he's like, you've been watching Winning Time. All of it is true. Except you don't know how good my numbers are. Here they are. I'm in the Hall of Fame. And you're like, oh, okay. Some serious shit went down. And Spencer's like, yeah, that's cool. That's what happened. All right. So you're at the Miami. You end up the Magic and the Knicks. And when it's time to wrap up, was it like no brainer that you wanted to get into some front office stuff and work in the game? Or how'd you end up with the Pistons?
Man, listen, I had no clue. You know what I'm saying? I was still like, I had got, what was that? That was 2013. Got cut at the beginning of the year after training camp with the Magic, got cut. I'm thinking like, cool, like, all right, you know, I'm going to clear waivers, go sign a vet minimum somewhere, do a little double dip. I'm going to be cool. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Hopefully I can get with a contender, get a chance to compete. I'm like, man. 1 week go by, 2 week go by, a month. I'm sitting here. I'm like, Jeff, what the hell? He like, man, listen, I'll let you know. I'm like, I'm getting mad. I'm getting frustrated. Then it's just like, you know, like, I think one of the biggest things that was happening then, my wife was pregnant with my daughter. And this is my first, like, I got my stepson. This is like my first kid that I'm really like there right. for. I'm like, yo. So that kind of had me like occupied and kept me like, you know, kept me sane. I feel like, cause I was like, yo, like, this is bull. Like, but then finally, like at the end of the season, I'll never forget, it was crazy because my birthday is April 13th. I'm sitting there like, all right, cool. It's the end of the season. Ain't number 2-3 days left in the season. Ain't nobody going to sign me. I'm going to go out to L.A. for my birthday. We rent a house, a little Airbnb or whatever. I'm out there for one day. I'll never forget because I went. This is when Steve Nash was with the Lakers. I went out. We went out to the club. They had a game that night. We went out to the club with him, Chris Duhon, and Earl Clark. They was all from, you know, Earl and Steve Duhon had played with me with the Magic, but then went and joined him. I played, obviously, with Steve and Phoenix. So we go out, get up in the morning. My agent called me crazy early. I'm like, do not do this, Jay. He like, the Knicks want you to come. I think they were like on a road trip in Portland or something. He was like, they want you to come fly to Portland and work out. I'm like, all right. So then, because you remember this year, the Knicks were the number one seed. They had Tyson, Melo, J. Kidd, all these guys, Camby. So I'm like, all right, cool. So first thing I do, we're in the house in like the hills or whatever. So I get up, go put my headsets in, we go run. Like, let me go run this alcohol.
Yep.
So while I'm running, literally my agent calls back like 30 minutes. Like, he like, all right, so they don't want you to come fly there. They trust you. They say, if you say you're in shape, you know, they know you from your long time there. They say, we're just going to have them come to New York and we're going to sign up for the rest of the season. So I'm like, all right.
I stopped. Back to partying.
Not even back to the point. I just stopped running and turned around because I'm already known. I'm like, all right, they about to have me leave like today or the next day.
Yeah.
So it was like, but I'm not about to keep running right now. Like,
right.
Turned around, went back. But it was like, yeah, that was like, so then went through that series, the playoffs with them, and we lost to Indiana that year. And that was like, that whole experience for me was like, you know, I was kind of taking it all in, like, because I didn't know. I felt like this could probably definitely be it after nobody calling the whole season long.
Right.
Then that summer came and the same thing going on. I'm waiting on. I knew I had to wait till after everything anyway. So I'm waiting. And then like Stan called, and he called kind of before he got what he got. He was just like, hey, I might get back into it. He was like, you know, I'd love to have you be a part of it. He was like, you know, I don't, you know, we could figure out what capacity, because I don't know what you're thinking and what you want to do. Because at that time, I feel like I'm trying to hoop.
Yeah.
But like, it became clear to me, like, bro, it ain't, you know what I'm saying? That ain't really what it is right now. And I didn't want to do the whole be sitting there trying to work out, wait for somebody to get hurt and all that stuff. I was like, I don't feel even comfortable, like, preparing in that way, waiting on somebody to be hurt. So I was like, I didn't want no parts or none of that. And the thing was crazy, because people don't remember, like, Stan was in the running for the Golden State gig first.
Yeah. And yeah, Stan Van Gundy, who's been on the pod, yeah.
I was like, oh, man, this might be my first little foray into it. I get to go, you know, because I mean, obviously, this was prior to them hitting their great stride, but everybody knew, like, when Mark left, that they were on their way to be something. We didn't know they were going to be dynastic, but we knew that they had a real good shot at being good. So I'm like, man, I'm like, cool. And then it was like, you know, I wasn't, like, talking to Stan the whole time he was going through the process, watching everything on TV. I seen Detroit come sideways into that. I was like, what?
Detroit?
I was like, what is happening? I was like, what? And then it was like, it came on like gangbusters. It was like, he going to each other. I was like, ugh. I was like, this is the worst. No disrespect, but like, when you look at I actually grew and had a different take on it prior to going to Detroit. I mean, after going to Detroit, but before going, I was like, yo, I had LA, I had Phoenix,
yeah,
New York, I had Miami and Orlando. I was like, Detroit don't fit in this picture.
Well, and Chicago people, like, I mean, I don't know. We always had that rivalry, you know, with Michael and Isaiah and the Pistons growing up with the Bad Boys. It's always like a little hint of like that little rivalry with Detroit.
Yeah, but see, for me, I feel like when I kind of like once I got in NBA, all of that faded away from me.
Yeah.
So it became different.
Because you bounced around a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, it did. That was different to me. But then, like I say, once I got to Detroit, I had a different respect for it. I had a different respect for the, you know, not only, you know, obviously the team and the city and everything, but the city was actually nice. Like, I stayed out in Greenfield Hills. It was real nice. So I was cool. I actually stayed in the same neighborhood as Aretha Franklin.
Nice.
Real talk, we got mail before the high house. My wife thought she was going to get to meet her, and she met her granddaughter.
That's a bummer. You, like, time it till you see her. Yeah. You're director of player development for the Pistons for a bit. You talked about being on the big three. You got recruited by your guy, Corey Maggette, to come back and play. Tell me about what – were there any apprehensions? Were you like, I don't want to play if I'm not going to be my best ever? Or was it like, I miss it, and I don't care if I'm not as good as I used to be?
Yeah, for me, it wasn't about trying to be who we were. I didn't feel like that's what the league was about or any of it. I felt it was about, like, getting back with the guys, playing, having a good time. And for me, my kids never got to see me play in no capacity. So for me, it was like, you know, cool. This is a setting where it was kid-friendly. We was able to bring our kids literally in the locker rooms with us before. You know, like, shout out to Nancy Lieberman, one of the best coaches I ever had, and she did a great
job. I loved that. I love that the team coached by the woman was the one winning it all.
listen, when I say, like, she did an unbelievable job. She took it serious. From day one, she said, listen, we're not in this for nothing but to win. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's saying, you're not here to win. I don't want you around here. And, like, that's how we're going to go about it. She conducted it like a real thing. We had scouting reports, game plans, and we did all of those things. And we had a lot of practice time. Our whole team showed up every time, because that wasn't the case for every team. And all of our guys, we bought in, and, you know, we got it done.
Are you done with the big three? You have any?
Yeah, I haven't played. I didn't play. It's been 2 years. It's been at least.
But you're not itching to get back. No one could call you up and say, "Come on back."
No. Nah.
You're done now?
No. I'm not. No more competitive hoop for me. The next time you see me hooping, it'll be me beating up on one of my kids.
Yeah. You still got it, or is it starting to fall apart a little bit?
Oh, Mark, see, the thing is, the jumper and shooting will never go anywhere. That's going to be like riding a bike. Yeah. I can remember when I played for the Heat. However old Bob McAdoo was then, he still could shoot the face off of whoever. Yep. Talk trash about it. And I say, that's how I'm gonna be when I get old. I'm gonna be out here playing the current players or whoever. And as long as we stand still, I got a chance.
All right. So the shooting's always gonna be there. It's the other. I remember I interviewed David Robinson a couple years ago for something, and I thought I was being all clever, like, oh, how long ago was the last time you dunked? And he was like, this morning. And I was like, okay, cool. He's so big.
Yeah, that's a, you know.
And he's only in his 50s. He's not like, there's some guy from the Bucks just made a video.
Marcus Johnson.
Yeah. And he still got up. It was impressive. All right, so you've made the full transition to one of us, you know, gas bag media members. And I wonder, when you were in the league, how did you feel about the media? Because I find a lot of the guys that complain the most about it are the ones who end up wanting to join. And I think part of the reason they complain is that they're smart and they see some of the bullshit in sports media. So they call it out instead of just accepting it. And then also they're kind of like loud mouths and contrarians, and they realize that could be beneficial to a career in the media. But what about you? When you were back playing, would you say you were easy to interview? Were you helpful to the media?
I was easy to interview. I mean, I feel like I played in some of the biggest markets. I come from Chicago, was, you know, played high school and at a high level, and then played college at a high level there. Then drafted to LA, 4 years there, 4 years in New York. So for me, I mean, I was always going to handle them straight on, straight forward. I only know one way, be honest and deal with it like that. So, and I, like you say, I felt like I was smart when it came to the media. They weren't going to, you know, finesse me or try and maneuver me into doing something that I didn't want to do, no matter how many different ways they asked something. If I gave them something, it was because I wanted them to have it.
Right. Like, we're never going to lose another game. You knew what you were doing. So now you do Knuckleheads, which is such a fun listen. You guys are so enthusiastic and fun with your guests, and you could tell you really respect and love the people that you have on. How honest do you feel you can be in those? Because we've just did this experiment on ESPN with Patrick Beverly, and we started to figure out some of the lines. Like, what's good for the game? Is it when people are super real honest, or is it sometimes bad if they cross the line and they have like beefs? So when you do it, like, how do you feel talking to former players about things that happened back in the day or now, and how much you have to kind of think about what you want to share and what you want to keep private?
So our thing, when we first decided that this was what we were going to do, and we like, okay, we agreed that this is what we're going to do, a podcast, and we want to talk to former players, and we was like, We want to represent them in a celebratory way, in a fun way, in a way like that we feel like we could access and we could talk about things that they and we will be willing to talk about, because it's fun and it's positive and it's going to be showing us in a different way that, you know, to show them to like, hey, these guys are human too. They do this, they do that, they crack jokes, whatever it may be, but. No, at no point do you got to worry about being blindsided, like, yo, why y'all ask me that? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, none of that. We're here to celebrate you, because we know that, like, we sit here as former players, former athletes, we consume and watch everything. We on social media, watch TV, and we see it's plenty of people that's covering every single bad move that we make.
Right.
Every single one, ad nauseam. Like, it's not just one handle or one form of me, it's all across the board. If we do anything negative, it's going to be wham, every which way you look. So it's like, that's cool. So we want to take the opposite approach. And we going, whenever we talk to whoever, we not, you know, idiots or you know, not knowing that they have flaws or whatever, like anybody else, the same people that's writing all of these things, if you go and put a microscope over them, somewhere you could find something that's not
perfect. For sure. It's
not perfect. So my thing and these things, like, we just here to, whoever we are, man, we here to have a good time, let you know you in a safe space. We about to kick it. We talking like we did when we were in the locker rooms or on the plane after games, or when we get together and hang out together as peers. And this is a safe space for you. Like, and this is a point where you can feel celebrated. You know what I'm saying? Because
that comes across for sure.
Yeah, obviously we want to talk to the Kobes and the Shaqs and this and that, but like, we still going to talk to the people like us that weren't however many time All-Stars or Hall of Famers or this or that, because we weren't that. And we realized that those people got some of the dopest stories and mean something to the game too.
For sure.
Because for every Hall of Famer, you can't have it without five of us regular guys.
Right. That's right. And you got some great women's players on. Sue Bird's one of my all-time faves. She's been on the pod a couple times, and Teresa Witherspoon and folks like that. So you love to hear from them too. It's a lot of fun. And you do make it clear, like, it's easy for people listening to tell how much fun you guys are all having, how it does feel like a good space for them to let themselves come out and be honest, be themselves, tell good stories. It's awesome. Hey, we're running out of time, but before you go, you do have to do the one thing that everybody does and nobody expects.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
It's the Spanish Inquisition speed round. Number one, your current career is canceled. You can't play basketball or do media. What job do you do instead?
I'm gonna take it back to the hood with it. I'm gonna go landscaping. I was cutting grass, shoveling snow, raking leaves. I made
love
all the
it.
Money. So I'm gonna take it to
I
landscaping.
I love it. That's great. Number two, what's the most scared you've ever been?
Probably when I think it was that with the heat, the lightning struck the plane, and we fell. I don't know how many thousand feet, and then when we got off the plane, you could see like the whole where lightning hit. It was like then, like I ain't never been scared like that. Like we was on a plane. I don't know what look. It ain't nowhere
terrifying.
To run. Ain't nowhere to hide.
Were
or
people
nothing.
Like yelling out like, "All right, I'll admit it. 5 years ago, I did this."
People was praying and everything, like real talk, like for real.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Number three, you could be the best in the world at one thing for one day. What is it?
I'd want to be the best at making people laugh.
Ah, that's a nice one. I like that. Number four, what current celebrity from movies or TV or sports or politics would you most like to be your best friend?
That's easy, The Rock.
The Rock? Okay. Okay. Have you met him yet?
Nah, but The Rock, I mean, he like the most likable dude ever.
Yeah. All right. We got to make this happen. I want to see that. Number five, what's your biggest, most meaningless pet peeve that you have?
People making noise with their mouth when they eat food.
So gross. That's a good one. Number six, what's the most embarrassed you've ever been?
Probably when I was way back in grade school. And I had the XJ900 song, and I was getting killed in the lunchroom. That was one of the things that like springboarded me into being able to cap and talk trash, because I got capped on so hard, and I never wanted to have that feeling again. Because I didn't have nothing for him. I was just sitting there.
Did you wear him again?
Nah. I mean, no, unfortunately I did. Because I didn't have a choice. I did have to wear them again, but I thought you were saying that I say something bad. But at the time, I didn't say nothing back. I didn't have nothing to say back. And yes, I had to wear it. That was one of the reasons I couldn't say nothing. Well, I realized now that I could have said something back, even though I had to keep wearing them. But at the time, I was shell shocked. Like, everybody looking.
Yeah. I'll just take it. All right. Yeah. number seven, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
Being more structured.
Okay.
I got to get better with my structure.
Like your schedule and how you spend your days?
I'm terrible with scheduling. Yes, scheduling.
number eight, any musician or band, alive or dead, can play your next party. Who is it?
Oh, man, alive or dead, Michael Jackson.
A lot of people say that. Yeah. Number nine, what would you consider your biggest failure?
I would probably say when I started drinking after my brother Lee was killed. That would probably be, like, if I could go back, that's probably one of the biggest things I wish I could correct.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Number 10. Instead of drinking.
Did you eventually do that?
Yeah, I still do therapy now.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. It's hard to be judgmental of yourself during moments like that of, like, great grief. It's easy in hindsight to go back and say you wish you'd done it differently, but you got to get through all that stuff when it happens and...
100%.
And you found your way out of it, which some people don't, you know?
Yeah.
So, number 10, what three individual words would you most hope that people would use to describe you?
Selfless, grateful, and confident.
I love those. I love when people say grateful. It's so important. This was super fun. Thanks for doing this. I've like really loved getting to know you by having you on the show. And I think I saw you at the Big Three thing here in Chicago and a couple other places, but always a nice smiling face. So friendly to everybody. It's much appreciated. Not intimidating for all the folks we have on the show coming on to talk about stuff. You're always, always super fun.
That's what she said.
Oh yeah. One more thing. This is a place for rants, raves, everything in between. I might complain about something. I might say something is awesome. Tell you something to read, watch, listen to. I mentioned ESPN Daily earlier in the podcast. Fantastic pod hosted by Pablo Torre. And they recently did an episode on the latest Brittany Griner news. Excellent reporting from TJ Quinn. Highly recommended to educate yourself on why Brittany Griner, the WNBA star, was in Russia, why she was detained, why the U.S. changed her classification to wrongly detained, and what that means about the efforts now from her family, the WNBA, and others to get her home, the politics behind the story, and more. It's really scary. She has now been in a Russian jail for months and months with no clear sign of release, and TJ Quinn's been doing an excellent job on this, so definitely worth your time. ESPN Daily podcast a couple days ago. You can always tweet me at Sarah Spain. If you've got guest suggestions, questions, or more, you should always go to the iTunes or podcast app, subscribe to That's What She Said, follow That's What She Said, and rate it 5 stars, please. Give me a nice review, and maybe I'll read it on the pod. Thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
That's What She Said.